Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So if you've been following the news in the last few months, you'll know that some major national organizations have been making really difficult choices.
Very controversial choices.
Exactly. We're talking about groups like the Women's Institute, Girl Guiding, and they're all grappling with who they admit as members.
That's right. And we're going to dive into the aftermath of a landmark Supreme Court ruling that really changed how a key piece of UK anti-discrimination law is interpreted.
And organizations have been trying to get their heads around this, often it seems, pivoting towards exclusion.
Which, as we'll see, puts them on some pretty shaky legal ground. It's really problematic territory.
So our mission today is to understand that central legal shift. Mm-hmm. What did the court actually say about the definition of sex?
And maybe more importantly, what does this mean in practice for any organization, whether you're a service provider or a membership club?
Right. How do you balance being compliant with the law with just the basic principles of dignity and safety for everyone?
It all really starts with one piece of law, the Equality Act 2010.
Okay, so let's trace this legal fault line.
Mm.
It all goes back to a single moment in April 2025.
Correct. We have to look at the Supreme Court judgment in For Women Scotland, LTDV, the Scottish Ministers. This was the moment.
The moment what? Exactly.
The moment the legal definition of sex in the Equality Act 2010 was clarified. The court ruled that when the act uses the word sex, it means biological sex.
That sounds very clinical, but the impact, I mean, our sources describe it as just massive.
Oh, absolutely. For thousands of transgender people who have transitioned, been living legally as their affirmed gender for years, this ruling felt like it just pulled the rug out from under them.
It invalidated their status under this specific law.
It created what one analysis calls a disorienting legal ambiguity. Think about it. You have people who hold a gender recognition certificate, a GRC.
Which is a powerful legal document, right? It lets you update your birth certificate. It recognizes your sex for marriage, for pensions.
Exactly. But here's the divergence. The Supreme Court ruling applies specifically to how sex is used within the Equality Act, particularly for single-sex exceptions.
So someone can be legally female for, say, getting married, but when an organization is deciding who gets into a women's-only space.
The interpretation of sex under the Act defaults back to biological sex. It leaves GRC holders in this bizarre legal limbo. Their identity is recognized by one part of the legal system, but can be ignored by another.
That's a huge inherent conflict that organizations are now stuck navigating. But I want to be really clear on this next point. The court ruling redefined sex, but it didn't just remove all protections for trans people, did it?
No, absolutely not. And that is the crucial point that gets lost in all the noise. Trans people are still fully protected under a separate characteristic.
Gender reassignment.
Gender reassignment, or GR. And that protects anyone who is proposing, undergoing, or has undergone any part of a transition. It doesn't matter if they have a GRC or not.
So the ruling didn't mandate exclusion.
Not at all. It just raised the legal bar for how you justify an exclusion.
So if inclusion is still lawful, why have we seen so many high-profile groups like the Women's Institute decide to exclude trans members?
It comes down to them using what are called the single-sex exceptions in the Act. They believe the new definition of sex gives them an easy out, but it's not a free pass.
There's a test they have to meet.
A huge one. It's called the proportionality test.
Okay, let's dig into that. What exactly does a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim even mean?
It's what forces organizations to think strategically, not just, reactively. First, you have to identify a legitimate aim.
Like protecting privacy or safety for existing members.
For example, yes. But the second part, the proportionate means, is where most policies fall apart. It means the action you take, the exclusion, has to be the least intrusive way to achieve your aim.
But wouldn't an organization just argue that excluding everyone who isn't biologically female is the simplest way to avoid risk? Why isn't that proportionate?
Because the risks they take on by doing that are often bigger than the ones they're trying to avoid. If you exclude without properly documenting why it's necessary and proportionate, you open yourself right up to claims.
Discrimination claims.
Direct or indirect discrimination under the gender reassignment characteristic. And the risks are very real. It's not just about losing in court. Our sources talk a lot about harassment claims.
Exactly.
An organization is liable if their staff, maybe feeling emboldened by the public debate, start engaging in unwanted conduct.
The example they use is a publican who keeps calling a trans woman sir or he.
That's textbook harassment, and the organization is on the hook for it.
Let's make this real. The guidance uses some examples. Take Danica, a trans woman, very visibly a woman, but without a GRC. Her legal sex, under this new interpretation, is male.
Right. So an association could restrict her access under the single-sex exception. But if they just have a blanket ban,
then they're in trouble.
They risk immediate dignity harm, reputational damage. They've even considered if, say, providing a single cubicle could solve the privacy issue instead of total exclusion. They have to prove that banning Danica was the only way.
And then you have the flip side. Jaden, a trans man, early in his transition, his legal documents still say female.
And this is where a rigid biological sex rule just completely fails. You'd be forcing Jaden into a women's space,
which goes against his identity, his appearance.
And it causes huge discomfort for him, and frankly, often for the cis women in that space who see a man walk in. The organization, trying to be legally rigid, just creates a new discriminatory situation and severe dignity harm.
This is exactly why organizations like Girl Guiding entering this territory need to be so, so careful.
The analysis to justify those exclusions has to be extraordinary.
So the bottom line here, the age of setting a simple policy and walking away is over. A blanket ban without rigorous documented proof is probably legally indefensible.
That's the key takeaway from all the legal analysis.
And that complexity leads to another problem, doesn't it? When organizations get obsessed with policing biological sex, they end up hurting people they never intended to.
This is the critical net widening effect. Policies that are designed to filter out trans women based on, you know, someone's idea of what a woman should look like,
they end up scrutinizing cis women too.
A huge number of them. Any woman who doesn't fit a narrow traditional stereotype is now at risk.
I'm thinking of Morgan, the example of a visibly gender nonconforming cis woman, a butch woman maybe. If a service is relying on staff to police who comes in based on appearance,
Morgan is now at risk of being questioned, humiliated, maybe even excluded, and she is legally and biologically female. The policy ends up discriminating against the very group it claims to protect.
We also have to talk about the intersex community.
We absolutely do. Think about Rosa. She was assigned female at birth, lived her whole life as a woman, but then discovers she has an intersex variation, maybe XY chromosomes.
Under a strict biological or genetic definition.
She's suddenly vulnerable. She could be reclassified, outed, or excluded from women's services she's used her entire life. It threatens the whole truth of her existence.
So this reliance on a rigid binary definition, it's not just hard to implement. It literally can't handle the reality of human biology.
Precisely. The legal duty to ensure dignity isn't just about what's in a statute book. It's about the lived reality in a locker room or on a membership form.
And we are seeing this failure play out in the real world. The data shows a massive increase in confrontation since that April 2025 ruling.
The stats are jarring. Roughly 1 in 2 trans people reported being stopped, questioned, or harassed. That's compared to 1 in 5 cis women.
And it's because staff or even just bystanders feel newly licensed to challenge people.
Yes, they feel they have permission to police gender. And when an organization has a weak or disproportionate policy, they are basically encouraging that kind of harassment.
So for any leaders listening right now, the message seems to be that this legal shift demands proactive, defensive action, not reactive, blanket policies. What are the practical steps?
They need to shift from sort of policymaking by press release to policymaking by data. Number one is rigorous documentation, an equality impact assessment, or EQIA.
That sounds dense.
Yeah.
What does an EQIA actually have to include?
It's the paper trail. You have to clearly document your legitimate aim, privacy, safety. Then the evidence. If you're claiming safety is the reason, where's the data showing inclusion has actually led to safety incidents?
And you also have to list the other options you considered.
All the less exclusionary options. And you have to explain why you rejected them. If you don't have that document, your policy fails the proportionality test from the get-go.
Okay, so that's requirement one, document the rationale. Requirement two is all about data privacy.
Correct. Information about someone's trans status, especially if they have a GRC, is special category data under UK GDPR. That means heightened duties of care.
You can't just have that information floating around.
Absolutely not. If you fail to control access to that data, you're looking at severe data protection breaches. Staff should never be in a position where they're asking about or verifying biological sex. They just shouldn't need that data.
Which brings us to the third requirement, training. If staff aren't supposed to police gender, they need to know what to do when conflict happens.
Training is essential. It stops unlawful acts on the front line. Staff need practical, non-judgmental scripts. So if a member complains about Jaden using a space that fits his presentation,
the response can't be to question Jaden.
No. It has to be to acknowledge the complaint while affirming Jaden's rights.
So a good script might be something like, concerns from other users do not automatically override our members' rights of access under the Equality Act.
Exactly. It recenters the organization as upholding the law, not picking a side in a culture war. The message to leaders is clear. Inclusion is still lawful. The path is just more legally demanding now.
So you have to ground your policies in defensible, evidence-based practice.
Centering lived experience to protect the dignity of all your members, trans, intersex, and cisgender.
This has been a really complex, but I think necessary, deep dive. We've unpacked how the interpretation of a single word sex in one court ruling has forced every membership organization to reevaluate its entire approach.
And the key thing for you, the listener, to take away is that the legal burden isn't on the excluded person to prove they belong. It's on the organization to prove why exclusion is the only proportional way forward.
And that challenge forces us to consider the ultimate human impact.
It does. The European Court of Human Rights holds that gender identity is one of the most intimate areas of a person's private life. So with that in mind, every organization has to wrestle with a final provocative question. When your policy of exclusion threatens the fundamental dignity and psychological safety of one of your members, how can you possibly demonstrate that it's truly the least intrusive measure possible? If you can't prove that, you haven't passed the test.